superheroes, mangoes, and butterflies. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Tens of thousands of people are in Fort Lauderdale starting today for the annual SuperCon, the comic book convention.
We've got Kevin Conroy, who is the voice of Batman in Batman the Animated Series.
I am the Knight. I am Batman.
Everyone watched Batman the Animated Series in the 90s.
Plus, it's that time of year for mango festivals. We'll meet someone who's been trying all sorts of mango combinations. She'll share them with us on the program. And we meet artist Frankie Cruz, who's created an exhibit for the MoCA that looks at the connection of monarch butterflies to immigrants. But first, we'll get an update on the turmoil in Haiti. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, peace is slowly returning to the capital of Haiti. Since last Friday, at least three people have died in the riots that left parts of the city burned and pillaged. The unrest is due to a massive increase in fuel prices, but how are the International Monetary Fund and the World Cup connected to all of this? Well, joining us now is Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles. She's joining us from the WLRN studios in Doral. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the latest from Port-au-Prince? I mean, have things quieted down?
Things have quieted down, although everyone is waiting to see what is going to happen next in respect to the current government, whether or not the government will resign or it will try to stay in office. There has been calls from the business community as well as political parties and members of parliament for the prime minister to step down as a result of the mishandling of the gas price hikes.
All right. Does that mean flights have resumed, businesses back up, or...
Flights have resumed. We had heard word that there was supposed to be some sort of a strike by the private sector, but I have not had a chance to check on that to see if that actually is taking place. There were general strikes that were called for Monday and Tuesday. Monday, there was hardly any transportation, but Tuesday, people were getting back, you know, on the streets. But it's still tense, you know, because the situation right now is folks don't know, are we going to have a repeat of last weekend?
Why did the government have to raise fuel prices, which, by the way, went up to 40%?
More than 40%. Gas went up 38%. It was 51% on kerosene, which is largely used by the poor to light up their homes, and 47% by diesel, which is largely used by the rich for their generators and their big cars. But basically, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, as well as others in the international community that includes the United States and the World Bank, for years, they've been telling Haiti, listen, your fuel prices are too low. You need to bring them up to global market prices. And while some people have been calling it a subsidy, really what it is that Haiti was foregoing collecting $160 million in revenue off of fuel. So they were keeping them artificially low.
And the Haitian government, my understanding from the reporting, was that they knew this was coming and they actually waited to announce this, right? And they were actually hoping to do this after the World Cup game. This is the World Cup game with Brazil, because everybody was, well, a lot of people were watching the game.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the police chief, because there's been a lot of criticism about the police and where they were. And in an interview he gave with the local press there yesterday, he said that they were actually going to do it on Thursday. And there was a security plan in place, you know, police officers stationed. Usually what they do is they go around the streets and they remove any tires, because usually that's the first thing the population do is they grab tires, set gasoline to it and set it on fire, and you create a barricade and people can't leave. Well, for some reason, we don't know why, they decided not to do it Thursday night. And instead, they announced it on Friday, minutes after the World Cup game, Brazil versus Belgium. And Haitians, you have to understand, are not just huge soccer fans, they're huge Brazil fans. So they were distracted. And I guess somebody had the bright idea of thinking that if we made this announcement while the game is going on, Brazil would win. And while people were out celebrating, yes, you'll have some people protesting, but you would not have the kind of civil unrest that we saw over the weekend.
They were hoping for a Brazil win because the euphoria would probably just like died, kill down the any anger.
Exactly. And that did not happen because Brazil lost.
And how did the news get out? I mean, was it social media? Somebody made an announcement?
Well, I have to tell you, I was not in Haiti at the time, and about 2012, I received a graphic on my WhatsApp with the new price increases for all of the fuels. So it went viral on social media. But while they were watching the game on the state-owned television in Haiti, which very few people were actually watching, they were having a press conference. But on the ground, yeah, social media, word of mouth, because it was within 5 minutes the first barricades started going up. And they just didn't go up in metropolitan Port-au-Prince. They went up all over the country.
And how about the prices now? I mean, are they up or are they stabilized or what's happening with that?
So after the unrest, the prime minister had a meeting at 7 o'clock that morning, an address to the nation, which I watched, and they continued to advocate and argue, you know, these prices. But by this time, after that address, people started, you know, pillaging. They burned automobiles. There were 7 cars outside of a luxury hotel that were set on fire. Another parking lot was attacked for a hotel. They went into people's businesses. They started looting. So whatever he said that morning, it did not calm things down. It seemed to have made things worse. So about 2 o'clock, he issued a tweet and then a statement from his office saying that they will temporarily suspend the increases of the fuel prices. But that did not temper things down at all. And right now, as of today, Haiti's gas prices are what they were last week this time.
So you talked about possible resignations. But really, at this point, what's happening with this administration, with President Jovenel Moïse?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, the IMF, they had a press conference this morning, and I have a story that will be going up online very shortly, where the IMF is not backing down. Their position is that Haiti's fuel prices are too low, and they disproportionately benefit the rich, and they need to go up. What they're saying now is that they're waiting for a revised policy, which they hope to see with gradual food increases, but also some social programs to help buffer the impact of this. Meanwhile, President Jovenel Moïse, he's been having meetings with different segments of the society. He also met with the foreign community, foreign diplomats. He's met with political parties. Outside of the foreign diplomats, I can tell you with the Haitians that he has met with, they've all told him in no uncertain terms, Prime Minister Lafontaine has to go. Somebody has to pay the price for what happened over the weekend. But so far, there doesn't seem to be any signs of this government falling, resigning, or leaving. On Saturday at 10 a.m., the lower chamber of parliament, they have set a no-confidence vote on the government if they do not resign before then.
What about the visitors who were trapped there? What's happened to them?
A lot of them have left. You know, I've been in contact with a number of people, some of them my friends, that unfortunately got caught up in this because it literally came out of nowhere. So you had people who were coming back from the beach. You had people who were, you know, going to the beach. This is Friday, you know, afternoon where people are usually, you know, going on their vacations or enjoying their vacations. And what this incident did was it basically trapped people where they were. So if you were at work, there were people I know who were forced to spend 3 days at their offices because they could not get home. People spent 3 days at hotels or tried to get to a hotel. But as the flight started to resume, a lot of people have started to leave and return to their respective homes.
Just a reminder for folks, how many different U.S. organizations and businesses operate in Haiti?
I don't know about businesses, but I can tell you is that there are a lot of charity organizations, NGOs, as we usually refer to them, non-governmental organizations. So a lot of them do charity work in Haiti. And I have to tell you, you know, in many ways, this violence was unprecedented. And for the people there on the ground, they had not seen this. But there also is an understanding of it. You have a country with double-digit employment, very few jobs, and you have a population that is highly frustrated. It doesn't justify the violence and what happened. But it was just the gas price increase was just sort of the final match, you know, that lit a frustration that had been building in the despair that people have been living in. So people who go to Haiti, whether they are associated with a charitable organization or they're Haitian Americans, they see the inequality. They see what's going on. And so I think that once this starts to calm down and we turn another chapter, you will see people will return because the people who go to Haiti to assist, they're committed to the individuals on the ground. Some of the very individuals who were going to be heavily impacted by this increase.
And, you know, the last few days, we've heard mostly about President Trump's trip to Europe and dealing with NATO. But have we heard anything from this administration, the U.S. government, on the Haiti situation and what role they could play?
Not really, but I did have a conversation with Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who was keeping a very close eye on the development. He's been in conversations with a number of aid organizations, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, as well as the IMF, to see what kind of packages that they can put together to try to assist people with the gas increase. Because the reality is what, you know, what Rubio and others are saying is that the mathematics are right. You know, Haiti's prices are just too low. Oil prices are rising around the world, and you have to bring them in line. The question is, how do you do that? And how do you do it in a way that you don't spark the kind of civil unrest that we saw over the weekend? So outside of him, and I did hear from Frederica Wilson. She represents the largest group of Haitian American voters in the U.S., who was very concerned about what was happening. We have not heard anything directly from the administration, but I will tell you that the State Department did issue a travel warning. They raised it to level 4, which is basically do not travel to Haiti. There were a small group of U.S. Marines who went in earlier this week, essentially to secure the embassy or to keep it further secure, and that's standard procedure. But I'm sure, you know, behind the scenes that, you know, there are talks and there are concerns because there's always that concern that anything that happens in Haiti can have the ramifications here in the U.S.
And finally, you know, we look at, again, the fuel prices have stabilized, but the IMF is putting that pressure on the government to increase prices. I mean, do we know about the ripple effects of those of that kind of increase, how it would have on the cost of food, goods, and everything else in the nation?
Well, I can tell you right now, Haiti is in for a very difficult time. I mean, the population was already facing low purchasing power. Inflation is more than 10%. The country was running a deficit of at least $150 million, while you're losing $160 million every year in, you know, in these fuel giveaways, if we, you know, can call it that. And so now that you have businesses that have been burned and pillaged, I mean, there's one grocery store chain where they said that 673 people have had to be laid off because now, you know, the store has been looted and burned and they don't have jobs for them. So it's going to be a really tough economic times. And we're going to have to watch and see what is the new program that the government revises with the IMF. And how does new increases, if they go that route, how does that work and how is it received? Because the reality is that they were doing this as part of an agreement with the IMF so that they can access at least $96 million in aid. And that's money that they truly, truly need. I mean, you have police officers who need to get paid. In fact, I can tell you that police officers had not received their June salaries until the night before the announcement. So they went 37 days without any pay, and they were paid late that night. There are always strikes about teachers over not getting paid. There are a number of social programs that they need to finance. I mean, this government needs money. And the question is, how do you get it? And the international community is saying, listen, you can't come to us and ask us for assistance when you're giving away $160 million at the pump.
Jacqueline Charles, reporter with the Miami Herald. She's got another story, another update on Haiti coming out today on the Miami Herald website. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, she joins us from the WLRN studios in Doral. All right, so it's our Friday, so let's lighten things up the rest of the show. Coming up, let's talk superheroes. Yeah, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. SuperCon is in South Florida starting today. All coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Oh, you remember that one? Yes. All those old great superhero shows from the 70s and early 80s. Well, how about this? From Wonder Woman to Spider-Man to Star Wars and Pokemon, if you're hanging around Fort Lauderdale the next few days, you're going to see thousands of them. It's the 2018 SuperCon, the annual comic book convention, and it started today. It runs through Sunday. Costume characters are just part of the four-day event. There's going to be hundreds of comic book artists, vendors, authors, celebrities from television shows, from wrestling, from everywhere. And the organizers promise that the traffic won't be as bad. Anyone remember last year, the first year they had it at the Broward Convention Center? Traffic was heinous. Well, we spoke with the creator of SuperCon, Mike Broder, who also created other events like South Florida Magic City Comic-Con, and well, he told us about what to expect.
We're SuperCon because SuperCon is more about the idea of the superhero or the super aspect of fandom not about just comic books. I love comic books. You can see behind me all this comic book art. I'm a comic book guy. And we have a lot of comic book talent. But the average person knows Spider-Man and the Avengers from the movies or the cartoons and not the comics. So while we have an amazing amount of comic book talent, I mean, I've got Adam Kubert, I've got John Cassaday, I've got Jim Starlin, who created Thanos. I've got some of the best comic book talent ever in the business at this show. We got some great comic book vendors. It's not just about comic books. And so that changed. That changed when Iron Man became the biggest movie in the country in 2006. That changed when the Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy made ridiculous amounts of money. More people have seen the Guardians of the Galaxy film than have read any Guardians of the Galaxy comic book. You know, and that's, so it's not just about comics. But comic books are a base. They're an important part of the heritage, the culture. You don't have the Avengers without the Avengers comic books. So it's important to celebrate that. But it's also important to celebrate the thing that people do love, which are the characters.
And you talk about fandom. And one of the fun things about going, if you're not dressing up, is just going to watch or to see people who come in their costumes.
Yes.
The costumes they put a lot of time and money into, because these costumes are really elaborate. But how do you describe the person who devotes so much time to their favorite characters?
There are different types. There's the person who just wants to wear a costume they bought in a store. And then there's the person that spent 9 months working on an intricate, amazing, you know, costume. There's not just one type of person that will cosplay. It's all types, and anyone can do it, and you can do it in any which way you want. It's just like any other art form. Everybody can interpret it their own way. You can have, you know, you can put a fine artist next to a comic book artist, next to an animation artist, next to an amateur artist who's drawing stick figures, and they're all doing art in their own way. And it same applies to cosplay. We've got people who do amazing, amazing stuff that are at a master's level that are creating, frankly, better costumes than you're going to see in some movies. And then you've got people that are just throwing together stuff from their closet, like we did when we were kids for Halloween, and they're just coming to have a good time. And the mindset is they're just going to celebrate the thing they love, celebrate, you know, the characters and the fandoms that they love and want to be a part of.
We saw over the past year, movies like Wonder Woman and Black Panther, big box office hits. Do you expect to see a lot of people coming this year dressed up as Wonder Woman and Black Panther?
Sure. There's always a lot of Wonder Woman. There's always a lot of there's not always a lot of Black Panthers. There will be a lot of Black Panthers this year. That will be new. But there's always a lot of Wonder Woman's, because Wonder Woman's one of the classic iconic characters. Everyone goes. I've got people, I've got children, I've got adults, I've got grandparents, anyone who is into anything, you know, tangentially related to this is going to be there.
So this is the biggest event that you guys host in South Florida. How do you relate this to, say, Comic-Con in San Diego?
It's a different animal. I mean, Comic-Con in San Diego is probably 130,000 people. We're going to be 60,000. So not as many human beings in the building at one time. They're more industry centric. They're more in the middle of California. There's a little bit more industry out there. This is more of our vendors are more exhibitors selling merchandise. We're more celebrity centric, at least in terms of the meet and greets. While they have a lot of celebrities, and clearly they have big, big names on Hall H, those guys aren't really doing, you know, the kind of stuff on the floor, the autographing, the photo ops, et cetera. We kind of have a little bit more of that. We have a large contingent of anime and animation programming and talent that will be there. It's related, but it's a little bit different.
This is the second year that you're holding this in Fort Lauderdale. Why not Miami?
Miami Beach Convention Center has been under construction for the last couple of years. So we are moving back to Miami Beach next year, 4th of July weekend, July 4th through 7th. Next year, Miami Beach Convention Center will be the home of Supercon again. But in the interim, we've been in Fort Lauderdale, frankly, because Miami Beach was, you couldn't put on a show of this scale during their construction.
Now, you're expecting another big crowd. As you said, I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of people. And last year, there was a big traffic mess because that's not the most ideal place when you have that many people. But what do you expect this year? And what are you going to tell people about what, you know, what they need to do to get through that kind of headache?
Last year was a comedy of errors, we'll say. I want to say this politically nice, yet still explain it, you know, truthfully. There may have been an individual at the convention center who did not believe that we had the amount of people coming that we said we had coming, even though we had a history of this in Miami Beach, even though this is what we do and every year it comes. Maybe they didn't take us seriously and didn't prepare for this. And we were kept out of certain planning meetings with city officials, county officials. This year, based on what happened last year, we have been involved very, very, very much with city and county officials, FLPD, BSO, DOT, having meeting after meeting after meeting. Now, 17th Street Causeway is a bit of a mess, even on a normal day when there's not an event where 20,000 people are trying to get to one building at one point in time. But we have plans in place that were not in place last year. We have, I want to say 19 FLPD officers on the street helping to direct traffic, helping to run the traffic lights, turning them on and off, you know, when needed, and getting traffic moving as fast as possible. We have DOT signs, the electronic message boards all over town, on US 1, on 95, on 17th Street, on Sunrise. All over town, we're trying to get messages across with signage and with manpower.
You know, one of the things, too, is, and you mentioned this, is that there are a lot of different celebrities who come in, and you'll see everybody from wrestlers to voiceover actors or actors who've played parts on television or in movies. At least my observation is that the lines tend to be longer for some of these voiceover actors, actors in cartoons and animation. Sure. Why is that? Who's in demand?
Well, it depends. You either have, I mean, some of the actors we have this year, the voice actors, we've got Kevin Conroy, who is the voice of Batman and Batman, the animated series. Everyone watched Batman, the animated series in the 90s into the 2000s. This guy's iconic. I have people grew up with him as their Batman. He's still Batman. He's Batman in the video games. He's Batman on the cartoons. So you've got little kids right now that are fans of Batman. You've got, you know, adults that grew up, you know, watching him as Batman. He's a huge guest. Tara Strong is the voice of everything. My Little Pony, Raven on Teen Titans, Harley Quinn in the Batman video games, Batgirl on the Batman TV series. I mean, so many other things. Her resume is just ridiculous. And again, people grew up with her. We've got these Overwatch voice actors that are coming. It's the hottest game in the world right now. Everybody's playing Overwatch, and they want to meet the people that are, you know, that portray the characters in the games. And, you know, the especially younger audiences, teenagers and young adults, they don't care about William Shatner. They care about the things that they're into, video games, cartoons, anime. And then, like I said, at the very beginning of this, I've got something for the young. I've got something for the parent. I've got something for the you know, grandparent. You know, William Shatner is going to appeal to an older crowd.
Why are superheroes still so relevant in our culture?
Why are Greek myths still relevant? Why did people, you know, care about, you know, the myths of old for thousands of years? Stories of heroes, stories of, you know, larger than life characters. This is, you know, ingrained in human society going back, you know, to our very beginnings. And right now the superhero is the modern myth. You know, you just look at the myth throughout time, you know, throughout history, and you just, you're just translating it differently these days. And they're colorful characters doing larger than life things. It's no different than the ancient Greeks talking about Hercules, the ancient, you know, Romans with their pantheon of gods, the ancient Norse gods, you know, any of that, you know, mythology. And it's just a modern take on it.
And that was Mike Broder, creator of SuperCon, the comic book convention now underway at the Broward County Convention Center. It runs through Sunday. And by the way, if you're one of the thousands who go dressed up as one of your favorite characters, please find us on Twitter or Facebook. We've posted some pictures from last year's SuperCon on WLRN Sundial Facebook. Share your picture. I'd love to see how devoted you are to your costume. And also, by the way, share it with us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. How bad is that traffic? Did they fix it? Because I'd love to know. All right. Just remembering some Spider-Man there. Still to come, it's mango season. You think you know your mangoes? We're going to challenge your knowledge next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you can find mangoes everywhere in South Florida. This weekend, the yearly mango festivals in Biscayne Park and Coral Gables will kick off. But why is this delicious blush red tropical fruit so popular here? And what's the history? What are all the varieties? There's so many questions. Well, joining us now via Skype is a South Florida mango expert, Dr. Noris Ledesma. She has written more than 30 academic journals and books on tropical fruits, and she is here to share her knowledge with us about mangoes. Dr. Ledesma, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And I want to mention, by the way, she is joining us via Skype. Okay, so, Noris, tell us, why are people in South Florida crazy about mangoes?
Why not? It's so natural for me. We are a great diversity of culture here in South Florida. We have people from all Latin America. We have people from Asia, India. So it's very natural for us to have that passion for mangoes. And everybody gets contagious about it. And everybody has mangoes in their backyard. And they want to have more. So it's very natural for our community to have that passion.
Now, I'll tell you what, I say that, but I, you know, not to pick on my friends, I know some people who really don't like mangoes. You've run into those kind of people, right?
No, very few. And the ones that are thinking that way, I convert them just in very few minutes.
Wow. Okay, so I'll find some of them, and I want to see you convert them. But when did and how did the mango arrive in South Florida?
Well, it's a long story. It comes from probably 1700s. The first mangoes arrived with the pirates. And it's a wonderful story about that. They arrived first to the Caribbean, to La Española, now the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And later on, they arrived to Key West, Tampa, and Mary Island. There are many trees still to tell these stories. Legendary trees, they are the turpentine mangoes, small with a lot of fiber. Now, many people complain about it, but those are the first mangoes that arrived to Florida.
And there are lots of different types of mangoes, but what are some of the different kinds of mangoes that we find, especially in South Florida?
Those are developed later on. That was like in 1900s. When Dr. David Fairchild went to India and brought 35 different mango grafted in a chip. Remember those days, we didn't have internet, we didn't have computers or planes. So he came in a chip and he brought those mangoes grafted. And by the time that he arrived to the United States, it was winter already. And Miami actually didn't exist in those days. It was a swamp. So he brought them to Washington, D.C. By the time he was able to bring them to Florida, just one was survived. That was the Mulgova mango. The Mulgova mango was planted in one of the backyards here in Coconut Grove. The mango matured, make fruit, but the fruit was already a hybrid. It was a combination of the mangoes that arrived by the pirates and the Mulgova. And one of those trees that were growing under the canopy of the Mulgova tree was completely different. A Mulgova is a chide yellow, pale yellow mango. And the turpentine is a tiny, a little thing as well. And the mango that grew up from this Mulgova tree was beautiful, red, and fleshy. And this lady, the owner of the house, was walking to get their mangoes, and she was remembering the tiny yellow mangoes, and she saw this beautiful red fleshy mango, and she said, "What is this?" And she took the mango inside the house to share this with her husband. And they were just amazed about how beautiful this fruit was. And they call it Hayden. The owner of the family was the Hayden family. So that's the tree that many, many people start cloning, propagating by grafting. And it's very common to find Hayden mangoes in different neighborhoods in our community, like Coral Gables, Pinecrest, Coconut Grove,
yeah,
South Miami, almost everywhere.
Now, you are kind of like a little bit of a mad scientist with mangoes, because you can also, you've tried to create different types, right? You've looked for a better combination. Mango genetics, I think, is a better way to say it. How do you do that?
What we are trying to do is old-fashioned genetics. It's just putting two mangoes. We are collecting the ancestors of the mango, the grand and the grandfather of the mango that lives in Malaysia and Indonesia. And we have them living together with the Haiti mango, the Tommy Atkins, Kid King, and 650 different cultivars that we have in our collection at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. What we are doing is we are making a cage, and we select one of the grandfathers with the Floridian mango, and we are using bees. In other words, we are putting two guys together. If they are close enough, they will make a combination, and we use those seeds and we germinate them again, and we have a new generation of mangoes. So we have now 650 different hybrids. But you're probably wondering why we are doing that, right? So the reason is that we are doing this is because we want to create a mango for the future, a mango that you can grow it sustainable with not many chemicals and not much input. And you can do that through genetics, because the domestication is wonderful, economically speaking. You can make profits when you can standardize the mango, but you are losing the resistance of the diseases, the adaptability to different conditions, and you need more and more inputs. And that mango is probably not as healthy you want it to be. So going back to the ancestors of the mango and checking the genes, you can create a mango that is more resistant to diseases, that is more adaptable to the climate change, the reality now.
Right. And as I said, sort of like a mad scientist in the way you're trying to find ways to create different types of mangoes. We're talking to Dr. Noris Ledesma. She studies mangoes and has written many academic journals and books on tropical fruits. She's going to be speaking at the Fairchild Botanical Garden International Mango and Tropical Fruit Festival. It's this Saturday and Sunday at the Fairchild Gardens. It's from 9:30 to 4:30. Dr. Ledesma, your theme this year is Haiti mangoes. Just briefly, could you tell us what you're going to be talking about?
We are very excited to be able to have the Haitian community with us. They have making a huge effort to bring 10 farmers, small farmers from Haiti, to be at the festival and share their story with our community. It had been a tough week, as everybody knows. They had different issues last week, protests for the increasing of the price of the gas, and they want to bring mangoes as well. So between getting their visas done and trying to get their mangoes here for the festival, I have to say, they are here already, so please don't miss the opportunity to learn and listen directly from the farm what is their story.
All right, so we are now in hurricane season, and I wanted to get from you just some ideas how people can protect their mango trees. What would you tell them?
The best way to do it is pruning. When you have heavy winds, that's just the first reaction is prune your mangoes. We have cultivars that are very dwarf, that you can make a tree no higher than your house. But still, you can put in even more and have a very dwarf tree that is going to take hurricanes. We have a whole description how to prune mangoes in South Florida in our website that I invite everybody to follow our documentation in our website. The main thing is you have to start early when your tree is still young and prune it in order to bring all that canopy down to the level of the ground. It's going almost to dress up the trunk of the tree.
Yeah.
They are just very easy steps to do it.
And also, just real quickly, before I let you go, briefly tell us, anybody who wants to grow a mango tree, what I mean, what's the best advice you could tell them about where to find one and how to start?
In South Florida, we for 27 years we have been promoting mango during the mango festival. And good mangoes are available in local nurseries. So they are suitable cultivars for South Florida. Very common, I can mention Angie, Nandagmai, Rosy Gold, Valencia Pride. Those are a Persian mango. Those are very good options for our community that are available in local nurseries. And they are going to be available during the mango festival as well.
Again, Dr. Nordice Ledesma, she is going to be speaking at the Fairchild Botanical Garden International Mango and Tropical Fruit Festival. It's this Saturday and Sunday from 9:30 to 4:30. Just getting a little flavor for the different types of mangoes that are out there, what she's trying to create, and also just some advice if you want to grow your own mango tree. That way you don't have to go to somebody's yard and pick mangoes off their tree. Maybe don't do that. Dr. Ledesma, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right, still to come on the program, an artist discusses the link between the monarch butterfly and the immigrant experience. That's all coming up next on Sundown here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, monarchs are colorful butterflies that are easy to recognize by their striking orange, black, and white markings on their wings. The monarch butterfly is known to originate in Mexico and migrate across borders to southern Canada and then back to Mexico through its life cycle. Now, this butterfly has widely been used as a symbol of migration and freedom within the immigrant communities. The Museum of Contemporary Art, North Miami, has a traveling exhibit featuring the works of 37 Native American and Latin artists who are exploring and addressing the themes of immigration, assimilation, and resilience. It's called The Monarchs, Brown and Native Contemporary Artists in the Path of the Butterfly. Now, this exhibit has everything from a greenhouse, video installations, paintings, and so much more. Well, joining us in studio is Frankie Cruz, one of the artists in the exhibition. And you can find photos and videos of the exhibit on our Facebook and Twitter. Just look up at WLRN Sundial. Frankie, such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Hello. Thank you very much. And good morning.
Well, good afternoon.
Feels like morning to me. Right?
For the artist's life, how did the monarch become a unique symbol that exemplifies the immigrant experience?
That's a weird question for me. I don't know. My work's not really necessarily about the immigrant experience. The show is, though. The Monarch show has a lot to do with that.
And how did you get connected to monarchs? I mean, what, you know, there's an interesting story you have about really how you discovered this, you know, really the cycle of the monarch butterfly and why it's important for you now.
So basically, how did it come into my
into your realm,
into my realm, my process, into my studio, and get to the point where I'm making paintings and living with them and creating with this creature and collaborating with them. It all started with a trip to LA with a couple good friends of mine, a gallerist named Anthony Spinello, local gallerist and artist Sinessa Kukek. He wanted to go see. We went on a trip to the West Coast. He wanted to go see the migration. It was part of one of the little pins that we wanted to reach on our trip. And got very excited that night and did a bunch of research. Landed on this YouTube video of, I could say, friend now, Chris from the Life Monarch Foundation doing a butterfly wing repair video, which touched me in such a way. And a friend of mine that you know, I didn't know that you can even touch this fragile creature, you know, at all. So watching this man repair that thing shows, like, I don't know, showed a strength and a strength of the creature that I didn't know about, and a learned that they did the migration, which is also like a huge feat, you know, just like subject matter you want to get into is like being an immigrant in this town and, you know, the plight of all immigrants coming in, not knowing the language, having to, you know, be brave. And
let me ask you about, you know, your exhibit specifically, because you have this interesting, you know, you have it, this interesting, like a greenhouse. Almost this little setup inside the MoCA where you are growing butterflies, right?
Yes, there's butterflies being raised, and there's probably one right now, but like about 13 have emerged since then. We've been releasing them, and that greenhouse is a reactivation of the laboratory. That it's a reactivation as a laboratory, but originally it was a quarantine to do the performance myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the performance I'm talking about is the butterfly ring repair performance. So that night in Los Angeles, I stumbled upon that video, and we were stoked. And I felt like I needed that empathy and that gesture and care for this creature that weighs 1/5 of an ounce. I felt needed to be brought into the art realm, right? Like,
so people walk into, because we have a video, by the way, but people walk, they can walk into this little space, this tiny little hut?
No, they
walk around it.
Yes, it's there's actually a
okay,
a warning label on there.
So you have these butterflies in their larval stage becoming butterflies because you're collecting something from them in creating this art. There's an interesting part of the process maybe a lot of people don't know, when they are becoming butterflies and they are producing something.
Well, it's more like they're not using something, so it's like they're discards. When they emerge from the chrysalis, they release this liquid, this meconium, and it's pigmented. It's beautiful. It's a burnt umber, yellows, yellow ochres, like magenta, even depending on the species. So every species has a different color. So long story short, I was trying to tell you. So we went from wanting to do the butterfly wing repair as a workshop into like that not working out, then being invited by Spinello Gallery to do a performance, turned into me doing the butterfly wing repair as a performance. So that's how the butterflies got into my studio, got into the process. Did the lab that's at MoCA right now was the stage and quarantine that turned into a lab, because in order for me to even do that, I had to do the research and get to know this creature and went into the studio. And then naturally, kind of like discovering penicillin, I saw, you know, noticed that the butterflies were already making these beautiful abstract paintings with the meconium. And
okay,
that's what I'm focusing on now.
Right. No, because again, when they're going through this process of becoming the butterfly, as you said, what they're doing is there is this chemical basically that they're using to create the color of their wings.
No.
Okay.
No, the color of the wings comes from scales that are upon the wing. The meconium has color in it, has a hue,
right?
But that's, I don't know exactly where that comes from, that color, because they
excrete it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So okay, upon emergence, they come out of the chrysalis, they break out of the shell, their wings are wrinkled, their bodies are swollen, they pump that liquid into their wings, and whatever they didn't use during the metamorphosis and all that, the discard, just like in mammals, comes out of them, they dry out, and they go and they fly.
And now
monarch specifically.
You collect that, and you created a piece, an art piece.
So I noticed they were already making these beautiful abstract paintings, right? These beautiful abstract paintings. So I started sliding watercolor paper under them. Then working on compositions to the point where I got to do this project at Locust Projects, where I did emerged over like 600 butterflies. But in the two pieces that you saw, or that one of your people saw at the MoCA exhibition, or the pieces that I have there, 420 butterflies emerged on that diptych onto watercolor paper.
And then there was something interesting about that, because now you've created, again, from the butterfly, this art piece. And the best way, too, by the way, is, again, we have photos up on our social media. You have to see this, because you've created basically this pattern with all of these butterflies, and they're now creating rows. Basically, they're creating the art piece with this secretion that you were talking about. You did this twice, once before a hurricane, once after the hurricane, because it showed you something about the butterfly behavior.
It was, it's a diptych, so it's two paintings.
Okay.
And I started, I put all the chrysalis on one first, and then I was going to move on to the next one. So they were both part of that same project that happened at the same time, except Irma came in between that process before the second table emerged. So I had to move that table to another place. And it was almost like we turned my friend's project space called Flower Box Projects into like Noah's Ark, because that's where we stayed during the hurricane. It's like a bunker. And I brought those tables with me there because I don't think Locust Projects was safe for the hurricane. So like, we had butterflies emerging in the warehouse, and it was a very interesting experience. Mm-hmm. But then the butterflies that emerged during the hurricane, you notice if you pay attention to the splatter marks and the marks that the butterflies are making. The first piece that emerged at Locust Projects before the hurricane, you can tell that it's very calm. The second one is a lot more chaotic. It's almost like they felt, I don't know, maybe change of air pressure. They felt the vibes in the air. They felt people's stress, you know. Everyone's freaking out.
So we could
make sense that a sensitive creature that small would, that a creature that small would be even more sensitive than we are.
Yeah, we could see in your work exactly there. It's almost like a behavioral change.
Definitely a behavioral change. Yes. They're a lot more chaotic. The splatter marks are all over the place, and it's a lot less organized. Even though they were sitting on the same grid.
What do you want?
Other piece.
What do you want people to take away from this exhibit, but specifically your work?
I want them to take away these beautiful paintings I'm making. Help me fund this project so I can continue making the work. But I don't know. Initially, when I first saw that splatter, the first thing I thought was, nature's already beautiful. Nature's already making the artwork. Like, let's connect with that. Almost like the abstract expressionists, when like they put a brush at the end of a stick to detach themselves, to kind of really let go, to be more expressive in their gesture and control less, and let the ego, like, separate the ego a little bit more. I'm separating even more. I'm like trying to actually maybe even not even be part of the process and set up this like system or like something like that, where basically I'm just taking away the human hand.
How much more do you want to keep working with butterflies? I mean, do you see this as part of your work moving forward, or at some point as part of the evolution of an artist, eventually you move on to something else?
Oh, I have so many other things that I want to continue. I'm going to work on, and things I'm working on right now that are different from that. But I think they'll stay in the studio forever, actually. Like, once that's, I have a butterfly tattooed on me now. Like, they're with me forever. Even if I'm right now currently working with something for the Frost Science Museum that's like this like water pump system.
So you because you're working with butterflies, that you've put in all this time now as an artist in creating works around this one little creature, now you have a tattoo of them.
Yeah, it's almost like my Boy Scout badge. You know, I got my butterfly badge.
Is it a monarch butterfly?
It is. It is a monarch butterfly.
All right. How big is it?
It's like 4 to 5 inches, you know. 4 to 5 inches square.
So just real quickly again, coming back, is this exhibit going on right now at the Museum of Contemporary Art, North Miami. If there's one thing you would say to people, how should they approach when they walk up to see your work? How should they approach it? What kind of attitude?
If you're looking at the paintings, actually, just be very curious. Pay attention. Slow down. Listen. Look at it. Same thing I would say, like, when you're coming into nature. Like, if you're going to the woods, going to the Everglades, you know, listen, you know. The beauty, like, doesn't explode in your face like a theme park. It like, sparkles silently. It's very subtle. You have to, like, sit there, listen, and pay attention. Like, look at that splatter. Get close to it and see, like, what I saw when I saw that iridescent, shimmering colors and, you know.
Frankie Cruz, one of the artists at this exhibit, again, at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami. It's a traveling exhibit featuring the works of 37 Native American and Latin artists, again, exploring and addressing these themes of immigration, assimilation, and resilience. It's called The Monarchs, Brown and Native Contemporary Artist in the Path of the Butterfly. Yeah. Frankie, man, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Awesome.
And that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.